It's time for Let's Talk with Brian Pettaway.
Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to Let's Talk. I am your host, Brian Pettaway, and welcome to March. Now, March is Women's History Month, and I am going to tackle Women's History Month in a few shows. However, I've gotten so many requests to rerun the show that I did 2 weeks ago, which featured Billy Murphy as my guest, that I'm going to run that again today and get that knocked out so that the rest of the month I can concentrate on women's history. Now, don't be alarmed because I will give you some women history facts before we bring on our guest, but there will be no Petty today. We're giving him a rest. There's not a whole lot going on in sports that we need to speak about. Everybody needs a break every now and then, and Petty's going to get his this weekend, but he will be back next weekend with all news in the world of sports. But like I mentioned, it is Women's History Month, and women have gone through some things in this country. They have not always been treated with the same respect that they're treated with today. And still today, their level of equity, equality, and appreciation, especially in the workforce, is still not what it should be. But in spite of it all, women have still played vital roles in the advancement of this country. And I'm going to give you a few of those facts right now. So I hope you're feeling great because I'm feeling great. And I've got a couple of women history facts to tell you this week. So let's get right to it. As I mentioned earlier, women played vital roles in the building of this nation. For example, during the Revolutionary War, as colonial militias armed themselves and joined George Washington's Continental Army, many of the soldiers' wives, sisters, daughters, mothers went with them. They traveled alongside the Continental Army, where they boosted morale, they mended clothes, tended to wounds, foraged for food, cooked and cleaned laundry, and cannons. For years now, there have been huge debates as to whether women should fight on the front line with male infantry soldiers. Well, let me tell you the story of Margaret Corbin. She was a woman who disguised herself as a man and traveled with her husband to the front lines of battle at Fort Washington. She helped him load his cannon, and when her husband was shot by enemy fire and killed, Corbin carried on fighting, even after being shot 3 times herself. She was given a military pension in acknowledgement of her efforts, and years after her death, was reburied at West Point with full military honors, as she should have been. Now, as I researched the topic of women in American history, I noticed that there was a trend of hundreds of women that disguised themselves as men early on in multiple wars, including the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, even World War I. And it wasn't limited to race. It wasn't limited to white women. Black women dressed up as Buffalo soldiers and became the best shots in the military doing the same thing. So I'm not sure why there was ever a debate in Congress as to whether women should fight on the front lines of wars. I mean, women have been doing it since the beginning and doing it very well. What I also learned while researching for this show is that many women served in multiple roles during World War II. And one of the roles in which they served I found rather astonishing. Not only did they sign up to repair planes from World War II, but they also signed up and volunteered to be test pilots for newly repaired planes, in which several women lost their lives. Still, they continued to repair these planes, and they continued to test pilot these planes, things that not even men on those repair lines volunteered to do. Now, being very honest, there are a ton of historical data that represent the strength and tenacity of women and how they shaped this country. And I will be bringing you more of those stories next week. Today, however, I'm going to do what I promised a lot of the listeners that I would do, and that is rerun my segment with Billy Murphy that I ran 2 weeks ago as my guest. And ironically, most of the requests, the vast majority of the requests, came from women. Now, I got to tell you, he's a straight shooter. He's very charismatic, he's very entertaining, and there is some profanity and colorful language. Language that you may deem to be too colorful for younger ears. So buckle up, strap up, and get maybe the little kids out of the room. But here is my interview with the Honorable William H. Murphy Jr., also known as Billy Murphy. All right, 1500 family, please help me welcome to Let's Talk, William H. Murphy Jr. Judge Murphy, how are you this morning?
I have no complaints. The good Lord has blessed me, and I'm on the right side of the ground.
Awesome, awesome. I really appreciate you taking the time. How do you like to be referred to, as Judge or William, Billy?
Billy Murphy.
Billy, okay. All right. I have you here today, Billy, because it is Black History Month. I'm trying to cover all my bases as far as Black history goes. And like I said earlier, you are living Black history in the city, but you're well known around the country. And It's interesting to me because I didn't know how you started, but apparently your father was a judge in the city, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, he was one of the earliest judges. He got elected in 1970, the same year Perry Mitchell became the first black congressman in the history of Maryland, the same year that Milton Allen became the first black elected prosecutor in the country.
Right.
The same year that Paul Chester became the first black elected court clerk in the history of the state of Maryland. And that's when my father got elected. He beat a sitting judge on the municipal court of Baltimore, which then was converted to what we now call the district court. And he sat for 34 years.
Oh, wow. So you grew up in Baltimore? What part of Baltimore was that?
I grew up in Cherry Hill.
Oh, in Cherry Hill. You've seen that change quite a bit then, right?
Oh, yeah. When I grew up, there were no drugs, no guns, an occasional fistfight, maybe a knife, but that was rare.
Okay.
And we had a ball growing up there.
Now, I heard a story about an incinerator in Cherry Hill when you were younger that was causing some issues. Apparently you were young, but you wanted to help out and try and get something done about it. What's that story all about?
Well, my mother assigned me the responsibility of organizing the community. I was 14 at the time, and I had seen her do it on numerous occasions. So it wasn't really difficult. All I did was imitate her. And that's the story of my life, by the way.
Oh, is that right?
And you know, most people don't have the benefit of a teacher like that. You know, someone who was deeply involved in the black community and wanted to help everybody she could without any benefit to herself except the satisfaction of helping somebody.
Okay.
And so that's basically the spirit of my household when I grew up. And it translated into who I am today.
I'm glad you said that because you had a judge in the house, you had a mom with an activist heart, but you actually went to MIT after high school. Is that right?
Yes. I got my degree in electrical engineering. I went to Poly. And Poly typically got 10 people a year into MIT.
Okay.
And it was a little different with me because I didn't graduate from Poly. I was a mid-year student. And so I went after half a year of my senior year, I went to MIT.
How does MIT translate into into law? What happened?
Well, MIT is the kind of education that translates basically into anything.
Okay.
Because it's an advanced degree in thinking. That's what engineering is. It has to be accurate thinking. Because if it's not accurate, things don't work. Bugs are, you create bugs in the software.
Right.
And it was a zero defects environment, meaning that you couldn't make any mistakes because we were working on stuff that was going into outer space.
Okay.
And one mistake can ruin everything. Billions of dollars and human life.
So when you finished at MIT, did you at that time think you were going to work for NASA or something like that? Or did you decide at that time, you know what, I think I really have the lawyer bug?
Well, when you're that age, you're not really thinking like an adult. You're not thinking things through. And so what my father had taught me that was that, son, in this environment where the racism is overt, you don't want to be working for white folks. It's best to get out of here and work for yourself. And I ignored that because I wanted to be a scientist. I wanted to be an engineer.
Okay.
And I got into a completely racist environment at the Martin Company, which is now Lockheed Martin out in
right.
the river.
Right.
So much so that, you know, one day my boss walked in and said, Murphy, how do you like Georgia? Well, Lester Maddox was the governor of Georgia. He became governor because he chased black people out of his restaurant with an axe handle when they were trying to integrate his restaurant.
Oh, wow.
Okay. The sit-in era, if you will remember.
Right.
So I thought it was some cruel joke he was trying to, you know, impose on me. So I said, why are you asking me that? So he said, you've been sold to the Lockheed Corporation. I said,
oh, wow.
Sold? I thought only baseball players or slaves could get sold. He said, well, son, I've never seen you in uniform. And, you know, I had to laugh at that. That was funny. But it wasn't really a funny situation at all. He said, son, you think this is about race, don't you? He said, come with me. So he took me out to the floor where nobody sat in the cubicle. You know, that was one of the problems when you were an engineer. There were 4,000-some-odd engineers back then, 7 blacks. And cubicles were not the idea because the boss wanted to be able to see who was working and who wasn't.
Right.
And so I saw all these grown men crying. They had just gotten the same news. And so he says, see Sam over there? He's been with the company 25 years. Integral part of his neighborhood, integral part of his community, bought a house. All his kids have been raised here. He's got to go.
Wow.
See this guy over here, Frank, you know, he's been with the company almost 40 years. He's got to go. And he just went down the line.
Wow.
He said, son, it isn't about race, it's about economics. And then I said, no, it's about the way corporations think about their employees, too. Don't forget that. And so he looked at me, and he said, well, son, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to think about it. And so I went home, and I saw my father immediately. I told him the story.
Right.
He laughed. He said, son, you're one of the dumbest Negroes in America. I've been trying to tell you the way it is. And so finally, this is it, huh? I said, well, what should I do? Should I go? And so he said, no, son, don't you go anywhere. You ain't got to go.
Right.
They have only a handful of blacks out there, and they only have you out there because they need you, not because they want you. They can't get government contracts if it's an all-white corporation.
Okay.
So, and then he said, and son, I wouldn't be surprised if because you decide not to go, they give you your first raise. I said, Pop, that's perverse. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. He said, wait and see. And it happened just like he said it was going to happen.
They offered.
I got my first raise. I said, I don't want to be here anymore. And then they told me how good I was. Well, why didn't you tell me earlier?
Right.
I didn't want to be there. So I looked at the choices I had. Didn't want to be a dentist. Couldn't be a doctor because I didn't take the biology or the organic chemistry. Wasn't good at business because I couldn't even make a profit on my paper route. I sold Afro every And so law looked like the ticket because, you know, I always thought I could be a better lawyer than my dad. That's what good sons are trained to think.
Right.
And so I went to law, I applied to law school, I got in, and I gave him 2 weeks notice after I got in, right before school started.
Right.
Never to return. And it's the best decision I ever made in my life, economically and politically.
And that was at University of Maryland?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And morally, you know, best decision I ever made because I went into the business of helping people.
Right, and that's what I wanted to ask. When you got into law, first of all, I was always fascinated with law and journalism. But law intimidated me, right, because of the LSAT and the bar. So I figured I would love that profession from afar, from a distance, and be fascinated from a distance. But I still like debate, and I'm still fascinated, and I admire great litigators and debaters and arguers. And how did you know that you had that in you to just stand in? First of all, it takes a lot of confidence in oneself to tell somebody, hey, put your freedom in my hands and let me argue for you. How did you know you had that in you?
Well, that's an excellent question because it really gets to the heart of what my family was all about. We were taught as kids, have an opinion. Don't say, oh, no. Be informed. Pay attention to current events. What kind of citizen you want to be? You want to be a citizen of Cherry Hill, citizen of Baltimore, a citizen of Maryland, or a citizen of the United States, or a citizen of the world?
Right.
Which makes the most sense. And so we became world citizens. We paid attention to everything that was going on around us. And debating? Oh, man, that was every day in my house.
Okay.
Well, why do you think that? Well, because blah, blah, blah. Well, that doesn't take into account blah, 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 does it? No. Well, what if you thought about that, too? What would your opinion be then? And, you know, and on and on and on every day. I learned how to cross-examine from being cross-examined by a lawyer who was good at it.
Right.
You know, I learned how to debate because you had to hold your own in the Murphy family.
Okay.
You get run over if you said something stupid or illogical or just plain wrong. I mean, it was great training. So, you had to be accurate in your thinking. You had to be logical in your thinking, or it just didn't make sense.
Right.
And so, you know, I came out after being trained. It was intense training, too. Ooh, man.
Yeah, probably more difficult in the household than it was actually in the courtroom, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because yeah. This is my mother and father getting ready to kick my butt.
Right.
And they rarely use
corporal punishment. Yeah,
and when they did, you were really in trouble. And you know, it wasn't a number of licks; it was how hard they hit.
Right.
And you know, it was no messing around. You had to do what you were told. You had to do it on time, and you had to do it to the best of your ability. And that encompassed every part of life. And they were clear, we ain't giving you nothing.
Right.
Except clean clothes, a clean house, three squares, and education and love. That's it. Anything else you want, any luxury stuff, any stuff that you don't need, you got to get that yourself, son.
Right.
So, you know, I asked him one day, I said, Papa, are we poor? He said, no, son, we broke.
There is a difference.
What's the difference? Yeah, I said, what's the difference? He said, poverty is a state of mind.
Right.
Being broke is temporary.
Right. What year did you get your law license? You passed the bar, and what year did you get your law license to practice?
I got my license in 1969, December. I graduated from the University of Maryland Law School in that summer, and I passed the bar that summer. Graduated in May, passed the bar in July.
Okay.
And then I clerked for a judge on the Court of Special Appeals, the chief judge of our court, another Murphy, no relation, Bob Murphy, great, great judge.
Okay.
And he later became the chief judge of our Court of Appeals. And it was a real learning experience to have the opportunity to clerk for a judge of his stature. And he taught me a whole lot.
With all of the different types of law that you could have practiced, what made you decide to get into, is it criminal law?
Well, that was the beginning.
Okay.
I was strictly a criminal lawyer for about the first 25, 30 years. But things changed in the late 70s. And so I started doing civil cases. I got the biggest verdict in history at the time of $1.5 million for a police brutality case in 1978. Cedric Meade was the name of the person who was injured by the police. Then I got with Marvin Ellen, who was a great malpractice lawyer. We tried a case together and got the biggest malpractice verdict in history, $1.5 million. And that was fun because we asked the jury for $1.2 million, and they said, can we give you more? We said, yeah, so they gave us $1.5 million. So aside from that, it was strictly criminal law. And then when I ran for mayor and lost, I went back into practice again, and I had seen lawyers do civil cases who I thought were absolutely dreadful.
Right.
And I said, damn, here I am being... acting with an oppressed mentality that stuff was too hard to do and all that kind of stuff. And then when I saw it being done, I said, I can do that too, and I can do it better than what I'm watching. And so I did. And then we started handling civil cases and getting big verdicts and settlements and, you know, making a lot of people happy, happier with their lives.
Right. I always wondered, because there's a lot of research that goes on with law. You know, you can watch TV and you can see the fast-talking lawyers. You just think they're just great extemporaneous speakers, and some of them are. But there's a lot of research that goes into practicing law and in being a good lawyer. So I'm wondering, how great a memory do you have to have? You know.
Well, that's funny. You know, when my first partner asked me to join him in the practice of law in the middle of 1970, or rather in the late part of 1969, while I was clerking, he was a tremendous lawyer, a guy named Leroy Carroll, and he won 45 out of 46 jury trials. And he just understood everything about the practice of law, and I just soaked it up.
Right.
And he taught me how to win, and he taught me how he prepared. And I tried to take it up a notch because I wanted to win 45 out of 45.
Okay.
I never topped his record, but I won 91% of my jury trials. And it's hard work is the key. You got to do all the work all the time, and you got to be more creative than your opponent. You got to see things he doesn't see. You got to understand how to paint a picture in the courtroom that's compelling. You've got to learn how the art of persuasion, and you have to read everything you can to learn that. You have to go to all kinds of seminars for training if you want to be the baddest. And I always wanted to be the best. You know, first year of integrated school, second year actually, I was at school number 49. It was an all-white accelerated school. There were five blacks in my class out of 45.
Wow, okay.
I got a 95 on my first math test, and I couldn't wait to get home and show my mother. You know, my father would say, "That's what you're supposed to do, son."
Right.
You know,
right.
So he wouldn't
jump up and down. Right.
Yeah, but I thought my mother would, and boy, was I surprised. She said, "Son, I don't understand why you got that big smile on your face." I said, "Mama, it's a 95. It's an A." She said, "You must not know what 95 means, son." I said, "Okay, Mom, what's it mean?" She said, "It means that you could have gotten 100, but you were too lazy."
Oh, wow.
"You didn't finish the work."
Ugh.
"Don't bring me any more 95s. I want straight 100s. You can do it."
That's pressure, man.
No, it wasn't. It was a command. She was right. I could have gotten 100s if I had done all of the work. And so I started doing all of the work, and I started getting 100s, and that's how I got an MIT.
I want to fast forward a little bit. You get this reputation as being a winner in the city. But one case fascinates me, and I'm kind of trying to figure out how this happened. You represented Don King, right? And
yes.
And won for him. How did you guys get connected? How did it come to pass that you became his attorney?
Well, I had been Kwaisi and Fume's lawyer.
Okay.
Still am. And he and Don were very close. And Don was upset with his previous lawyer, and a white guy who had a very conservative style, happened to be a great lawyer, though. I mean, he's a great lawyer, a guy named Peter Fleming.
Okay.
And Don's upset came from a hung jury. Peter put Don on the stand. Half the jurors didn't believe him. And so it was a hung jury. And Don was upset. And so he said, "I need somebody who's got real power in the courtroom. All this sophisticated stuff, it isn't getting the job done." And so Christ, he said, "I know just the guy. Name is Billy Murphy. And I can vouch for him, Don." And
wow.
So that was that. Don called me. I didn't believe it was Don King because Kwaisi didn't warn me.
Okay, okay.
And I said, "Mr. King," not thinking it was Mr. King, I said, "Can I call you back in 5 minutes? I'm dealing with an issue here that requires my immediate attention."
"Okay, call me back."
So I called him back.
He said, "You didn't think it was me, did you, son? It's time to put your big league pants on. I want you to represent me." So he flew me down immediately.
Where was he?
And he was in Deerfield Beach, Florida.
Florida,
right,
okay.
Outside of Miami, about an hour north of Miami.
Okay.
Half an hour short of West Palm, or south of West Palm. So, you know, I want my son to get involved. My son was practicing law in one of the oldest firms in New York.
Okay.
Very prestigious firm. And I called him and told him what happened. And so I said, it's time for you to come play with your daddy. And so he was chasing, he was representing a potential first round draft choice in the NBA. And he was out in New Mexico or something like that talking to him.
Okay.
And I prevailed on him when Don King got on the phone too and said, come on out here, young man. Got a lot of things to show you. And so Son flew out, and he took a leave of absence from his law firm, and we tried that case together.
And you got, was it
Peter Fleming, by the way? You know, I told Don we needed to keep Peter in the case.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Now, it was nine counts? You got all nine counts dismissed? Did I read that right?
I forget how many counts were. There were a lot. And yeah, we got Don acquitted, and we got his corporation acquitted.
Wow.
Because they prosecuted his corporation too. They were trying to put his lights out.
Right.
Trying to put him out of business.
So
that was a major turning point in my career, because I found that the things that I was doing in the courtroom in Baltimore were universal.
Right.
You know, and so I could hit big league pitching, and I started getting big league pitching. And, you know, I went from there to Microsoft, to H&R Block, to, you know, major insurance companies, including Scottsdale Insurance. And these were huge engagements where
right.
There were billions of dollars at stake. And, you know, I did just fine, because I never wanted to be a corporate lawyer. I wanted to represent people.
Right.
And so when I came back from doing that, because it took me out of town a lot, I had two big cases in New Orleans. I had a couple big cases in New York, in Philadelphia. You know, I was going around the country, Chicago, St. Louis. It was good to come back home and start representing black folks all over again.
Right.
And that's what I do. Now, I don't turn down white folks. Don't get me wrong. I have a lot of white clients.
Right.
But I got into this business to provide excellent legal service to black people who I didn't think were getting it.
So,
and that's still the theme
of what you do. Really quick, I got to ask this question. As a defense attorney, does it matter to you if your client is innocent of the crime or guilty of it? Do you even ask?
My job is not to be anybody's judge. That's what I did when I was on the bench wearing the black robe. But a lawyer has to be loyal to his client's best interests.
Okay.
And that means you disregard things like guilt or innocence from a moral standpoint. It is not my job to judge my client. It is my job to represent my client effectively. And my philosophy is to win this case.
Okay.
I don't go in there trying to compromise. I go in there to win. And sometimes it's better to fold them rather than to hold them. And you got to know when the risk of loss of a trial is too high. You got to tell the client that. People came to me to try cases and to win those cases, and that's what I did.
You have a moral compass, obviously. Do any of your clients or any of the cases that you tried, did it ever cross your moral compass where you're like, this is too much? Anything like that?
Well, I made a serious mistake in a case by turning it down. I had over 200 white clients on the Eastern Shore. They were mostly watermen.
Okay.
And they had hired me originally because the white lawyers over there were not effective in representing them. And they were desperate. And I won 144 cases out of the 146 they brought to me. And that's not including one case about, I guess, 15 years ago, where I represented 85 people who were arrested as a result of a illegal search warrant issued on the Eastern Shore, which covered the customers of a business.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't just the business owners and their employees that got searched. Anybody who came in the store got searched.
Oh, wow.
And on the Eastern Shore, you know, law wasn't wasn't right. exactly fair. Right. It was like Little Mississippi down there.
Right.
And I was winning down there. And, you know, it was amazing. So going down on the Eastern Shore especially was difficult because you had overt racism down there. You could see it in their eyes. Nigga, who you think you are?
Right.
That kind of stuff. I had judges turn their back when I tried to shake their hand.
Yeah, but how do you
do you
litigate? That's the question. If you're in Baltimore and there's a not an all-black jury, but there is some black representation on the jury, that's one thing. But when you're talking to an all-white racist jury, how do you present your case? Do you present it differently? Do you code, you know, kind of like, how does that work?
No, first of all, you put on compelling arguments because there's no such thing as black persuasion or white persuasion. It's persuasion.
Okay.
You ought to be able to persuade anybody from any background to your point of view. That's the objective.
Okay.
Now, during jury selection, of course, you want people that are more favorably disposed to you than they are to the prosecutor.
All right.
And you've got to participate in picking a jury that in all likelihood is going to agree with you. But that doesn't always work. But after I started representing white watermen, the white community liked me down there because I was winning.
Okay.
And, you know, I'll tell you a conversation. There was a guy named Mike Milliman, who was the deputy attorney general for a while under Steve Sachs back in the 80s.
Steve Sachs.
Bought a place down on the water.
Okay.
And his next door neighbor was the head of the Watermen's Association. And so... He reported the following conversation to me. He said, Mr. So-and-so, I used to be in the attorney general's office, and one of our departments under my supervision was the Department of Natural Resources, and their police are the ones that are always arresting you all on the water.
Right.
So I don't forget to think about me, you know, when you have a problem like that. And he looked at him. He said, Well, Professor, we all already got a lawyer. He said, who's that? Oh, he's the best criminal lawyer in the state of Maryland. And, well, who's that? He said, Billy Murphy. And Mike's jaw dropped to the ground. And the guy saw his reaction. He said, yeah, I know he's a nigger. He said, but he's a good man. So I was the good nigger.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Wow. So,
well, no, everybody deserves a lawyer, especially those guys, because they were continually being treated unfairly because their lawyers weren't prepared.
Right.
And I did a statutory analysis before I met with them. I thought I was going to be meeting with a bunch of black people. And I had to analyze the statutes. I was prepared to talk in detail about what their problem was and how I proposed to solve it. But it turned out to be about 100 white folks.
Right.
In a crab shack. I mean, a crab picking house, you know what I mean? It's
right.
Not a retail establishment. It's an empty, open building with aluminum or steel tables and chairs. And people sit around the tables, you know, picking crabs.
Right.
And they didn't expect that I was going to be as good as I was. I didn't know what to expect, but the reason that I got recommended was I was winning cases on the Eastern Shore representing black people.
Okay.
And they said, damn, if he can do that, he can represent us, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
And, you know, my practice exploded down there. And I try to tell these young black lawyers, it's not about color, it's about quality. If you are of the appropriate quality, somebody going to knock on your door and give you an opportunity to use that quality for their benefit.
Right.
And I always believed that the better I got, the more goodwill would follow me in whatever community I practice.
I got one more question for you before we roll. You did run for mayor of the city of Baltimore.
I ran against William Donald Schaefer.
There you go.
The most popular mayor in the history of the state of Maryland.
Exactly. Having run that race, when you look at the race that's being run right now, with the incumbent, Brandon Scott, and the closest one to him, as far as popularity goes in the city, Sheila Dixon. I always ask myself this question. I've asked it recently a thousand times. Is that the best that we can do? Based on what they've done and what Sheila Dixon was ousted for before, do you feel that that is, I just don't know if that's the best that Baltimore has to offer.
Well, let me just say this as background to the answer.
Okay.
What we have to learn, the same as what the Italians had to learn, same as what the Irish had to learn, is that corruption is intolerable if you're going to lead a people who are oppressed.
Right.
Because they can put your lights out and ruin however good your leadership would have been. You know, because if you commit crime, your brilliance is extinguished.
Right.
And that's just stupid. But you see, we don't realize that public life is unforgiving, meaning you don't have the option to make even one mistake.
Right.
Because it can be your one and only mistake and your last chance to be a public servant. Because the morals that are required to be an excellent political leader are much higher than the morals that are required to get through life as simply an honest man. You have to be hyper-honest. You have to fill in forms verifying your honesty. You have all kinds of additional requirements. And so it's very tough for me to stomach what I see. And I'm not talking about any particular person. When I see people who claim that racism is the problem, and they do things that put themselves right in the devil's mouth.
Right.
And then claim that what's happening to them is unfair. When what really happened was that you didn't avoid impropriety. You did not avoid being straight up.
You gave ammunition.
You did not rise to the moral requirements of the job.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, I see young lawyers doing the same kind of stuff. They don't realize that the moral requirements of being a lawyer are much higher than just being a regular citizen. You have a code of ethics, and you can be disbarred if you violate that code of ethics. And we have among the highest disbarment rates of any ethnic group in the history of the state of Maryland. Now, do I know for sure what the immigrant lawyers used to be like before they understood this? I have some idea, and I've read their books.
Okay.
It requires a rectitude that is five times higher than in ordinary life. And so if you want to be in one of these trusted positions, like being a public official or a lawyer or a doctor, and you're not willing to upgrade your ethical and moral outlook so that you don't get disqualified from doing that job, well, we don't need those kind of people in public office. We don't need them.
Right.
Because they ruin our agenda.
Absolutely.
And you know, to convert it, and sometimes it is racism. Sometimes, I thought in particular, Marilyn Mosby's case.
Right.
Did she make some mistakes? Yes. But were they out to get her and
Absolutely.
Looking for any possible mistake she could have made in her life?
Absolutely.
That was within the statute of limitations? Abso-fucking-lutely.
Right.
And we don't need prosecutors like that. We need prosecutors that don't go headhunting. I mean, if you're in the mob or something like that, oh, that's different. If you're head of a drug organization, that's different. But don't go headhunting and black politicians just because you think you're going to find something. You know, that's just not the way government should work.
I agree.
And so I was a big supporter of Maryland and still am. Now, was she a perfect state's attorney? Not by any stretch of the imagination, but she was one of the bravest public officials we've ever elected.
Right.
And she set a new tone about what we should do about serious police misconduct. And she kept her word that she was going to be vigilant to stop the police in Baltimore from being corrupt and brutal. And she inspired prosecutors all over the country, young black prosecutors. especially, but white prosecutors too. And so her agenda swept the country. When they saw what she did, how she stood up in Freddie Gray, we all stood tall right. with her. That was a wonderful moment and a wonderful lesson in leadership.
But it put a target on her back.
Absolutely, man. People came out of the woodwork to get her after she made that announcement of those indictments. After what she said to make sure that black people did not erupt into violence, because it was tight in Baltimore. That thing could have exploded.
Absolutely.
But Maryland kept that from happening.
Right.
And so yeah, I'm a tremendous supporter. I'm never going to forget the revolution that Maryland inspired and in how we look at police misconduct and how we have to be courageous as black public officials, because she was nobody's Uncle Tom, that's for sure.
No, not at all.
Now, that's a prescription for disaster, because when black leaders emerge like that, they are automatic targets, because they piss a lot of racist white people off.
Right.
And if you piss off a racist prosecutor, and I'm not calling that prosecutor racist, I don't know him well enough to do that, but I know racism exists in U.S. attorney's offices because they represent a cross-section of America, and white America has a high level of racism in it.
Right.
Some estimate at least 50% of the white community is overtly racist. So, yeah, they slip into all roles in society. You can expect a heavy percentage of white public officials and white people with whom we have to come in contact to be undercover racists or overt racists. Right. Now, overt, it's, you know, they're too smart for that. But Trump is getting a whole lot of dumb white people to become overtly racist. You know what I mean? and it's a terrible thing to see. I've never seen America this angry based on race.
Right.
Not even during the height of the civil rights movement. But Trump unleashed some awful stuff. And America has radically changed in the Midwest and in the South and in the Southwest and, in pockets all over the country. From being quietly politically correct but undercover racist to overt racism, and they're causing it to spread. And you have all these young people who are following
yep.
racist lead.
Yep.
And it's terrible. And look, people say, well, Donald Trump is not a racist. How can you call him that? Oh, please grow up somewhere. Sit down somewhere. Listen and learn. We are the experts in racism. We know what racism
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
You don't. You barely acknowledge that this is a racist country. And so, because you deliberately blind, you're gonna beat us down? No. You got to call it the way you see it. Now, there are two kinds of ways to talk to people. Ineffectively and effectively.
Right.
Was she always effective? No, because she was an angry black woman, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Let me repeat that. She had a lot of reasons to be angry about what she saw, both growing up and as she moved through the halls of power.
Right.
And she did her best to eliminate the things that she thought were unfair. I will never forget her. I will always look up to her and her contribution. I will always be by her side, both thick and thin. And Nick is, I feel the same way about Nick. Now, they made mistakes, yes. But look who they are. Look what their intent was. Borrow their intent and do it better.
Right.
Borrow the intent of Marilyn Mosby. Learn how to even tap that intent and get out there and represent us with power and conviction and integrity, so we can be a full-fledged participant in American life for the first time.
Right.
Because we're not yet.
Do you think she's going to do time?
I hope not. I hope that the African-Americanness in this judge is the predominant view that she takes of the situation, not the white view.
Grigsby you're referring to?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, she's an African-American. Right. Don't forget who you are, Judge.
Right.
Don't forget what she went through. And to square the circle, as soon as she made that announcement in Freddie Gray, people from all over the country were filing complaints against her.
Yeah.
Law professors in D.C., Virginia, you know, oh, what she said was terrible. And so she had to hire lawyers. It broke her.
Yeah.
She got sued by everybody. It broke her. She ran out of money because she was being sued all the time or investigated all the time or indicted.
Yeah.
And young people, if you're listening, be clean as a whistle. Because if you're not, white man's coming after you. If you're about something, if you mean something to the black community, if you are brave, if you are bold, if you are creative in solving our problems, you're going to have white enemies. Now, if you can't take it, if you're going to be a punk, stay home. We don't need you. You're setting us back.
Right.
If you're too scared of white folks to do the right thing instead of the white thing, how can we possibly respect you? But if you're going to do the right thing instead of the white thing, I'm all for you. And it takes, as I said, courage. And the one thing that I got from my parents, and maybe I was born with it, I don't know, was courage. I thought courage was normal until I went out into the world.
Right.
I thought my mother and father were normal people. No, they were not. There are a lot of people out here who should have courage who don't have courage.
Right.
And courage is the number one quality you must have to be an effective leader. Because if you don't have courage, you don't have the courage of your convictions.
Very true.
Because your convictions will sometimes put you in tough spots. You stand for what's right instead of what's white or what's wrong. And you don't deliver the goods, then you have punked out at the expense of the people who need you the most. And nobody ever called me a punk.
No, they didn't. Called you other things, but punk wasn't one of them.
Yeah, they got other names for me, but punk ain't one of them.
This is very, very true. Very true. Well, listen, I can't believe that you gave me this amount of time, and I'm so appreciative. I really, really mean it. You plug yourself. Where's your firm? What's it called? What do you do? How's it work?
The firm name is Murphy Falcon and Murphy. Dick Falcon is half Cuban, half Puerto Rican, and he's been a member of the firm since 1971 when he started with us unofficially. But he's still a member of the firm, and that's why it's called Murphy Falcon and Murphy instead of Murphy and Murphy.
Okay.
And he was a valuable member of the firm. Valuable member. So, yeah, Murphy Falcon and Murphy. 1 South Street. That's at the corner of Baltimore and Guilford. Guilford becomes South Street at Baltimore Street. And we're right there on that southwest corner. And we're on the 30th floor in the penthouse.
Of course
we occupy the suite where Alex Brown Company was headquartered. That was the owner's suite up there. And we always wanted it because they were among the biggest slave traders in the history of this country.
Right.
And so to sit in that chair, to have a nigga in that chair.
Is everything.
Oh my God.
Is everything.
That's thrilling, yeah.
All right. Well, sir, I appreciate you very much. And listen, I got to tell you, you know, I'm going to be calling you again. So I appreciate you very much.
Hey, no problem. My last point is this.
Mm-hmm.
We are not niggers, but we have been niggerized.
Explain.
There's a big difference.
Explain really quick.
We are full-fledged members of the human race.
Right.
Who have been niggerized by being recategorized as subhuman and subjected to the awful journey that our ancestors have made, a journey which the DeSantises of the world don't want white folks or black folks to know about.
Right.
so that they can do the right thing instead of the white thing.
Wow.
We are a niggerized people, even though we are not niggers. That's their label for us. We should reject that as a characterization and understand that they niggerized us. And we need to de-niggerize ourselves. And it's turning out to be a hard job, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly
is. Because the psychological trauma that was inflicted on us
runs deep in generations.
Runs deep. And see, white folks don't want to understand that. It should be obvious. If you put white folks in slavery for 40 years and brutalize them like we were brutalized and recondition their brains into thinking like slaves and to thinking less of themselves, and then suddenly the white man said, well, you're free to go. And you don't have the mentality to succeed. You don't have the social structures in place to succeed.
Right.
You don't have the community support to succeed. You don't have white doors in corporate America flinging open to make up for your oppression. As a matter of fact, today you see the white corporate doors are closing because Donald Trump put racist judges on the Supreme Court.
Yes,
yeah,
he did.
I said it.
He did.
I said it. I said it. I said it out loud. I said it publicly. And so we know what they're going to do. And they're going to try to rip anything smacking of affirmative action apart and set us back another 40 years. And to you young black folks out there who think Trump is attractive as a candidate, as an alternative to Joe Biden, get serious. Donald Trump is a racist who does not have our best interests at heart. And I know you might be mad at Joe Biden on a particular issue or issues, but overall, he's far better for the best interests of the black community than Donald Trump. And that should be obvious.
Right.
But it's not. And yes, could we have put somebody else up as a candidate instead of Joe Biden yet? But we didn't. We can't because Joe is bringing home the bacon.
Right.
In large quantities. If you haven't noticed, black folks, he's put black folks in every conceivable position of power.
Right.
From the vice president on down, Black Secretary of Defense, Black Chief of the military. I mean, on and on and on and on. And my problem with Joe is that he put on so many black people that he's inflaming the white races.
Right.
And they have the stupid belief that we're going to replace them. Well, that process hasn't even started. I mean, I don't see any widespread replacement of white folks. I see the opposite. I see white folks making inroads and replacing us.
Right.
I see white anti-Semitism growing. And unfortunately, there's some white bigotry against Jews, or black bigotry against Jews in our own community, which must stop. Dr. King taught us the evils of bigotry.
Right.
We said we learned those lessons. Evidently not. We're the last people that can afford to be bigots or racists. Now, we can't be racist unless we have power to control the direction of society. Bigotry plus power is racism.
Correct.
Otherwise, it's just bigotry. And so we can be bigots, but we can't be racist because we don't have the power to be racist. And every place we get tested, music, art, you name it, education, we have never been bigoted towards white folks. We've opened our doors
at
all the black colleges and universities to white people.
That's very true. That's very true. That's a good point.
So you know, when a white man or woman is ignorant, and that's not the criticism you think it is. That just means you don't have the information. When you have poor white people who don't have education, meaning they don't have enough information to function at a high level in this society, they haven't been properly trained, this, that, and the other, you can sell them refrigerators even if they live in the North Pole.
Right.
And Donald Trump is an expert at that. He has figured out their mentality. He has taken full advantage of them. He uses them for his own selfish purposes. Not to help them, because they're still in the same situation they were in before Donald Trump got elected, except that he's made an emotional connection with them, and they're so happy with him that they will do whatever he tells them to do. Now, if that isn't ignorance,
it's scary, but it's very scary as well.
Now, what I'm mentioning in this is not just for face value. It's obvious on its face why I'm mentioning, but I have a hidden reason.
Okay.
Black children need to know that white folks are just like us. They got some geniuses, mostly average, with a liberal sprinkling of fools, just like us.
Right.
And when they have dumb doctrines, they're weak. Racism is a stupid philosophy. The notion that you can see from far away that I'm black and you got all kind of opinions about how I'm less than you and I'm less than human beings is just dumb. And if you haven't absorbed our genius through our music, our dance, our sports, everywhere that we have been permitted to excel, use this with a ball or with drumsticks or up on the stage dancing and singing. If you can't understand that our genius is universal, our musical genius has taken over the music of the world.
Right.
We have produced perhaps the greatest musician of all time, a guy named John Coltrane.
Right.
You know, if you can't understand our genius, you're just stupid. You know, you don't want to understand it. That's your stupidity. You can understand it if you want to. But you don't want to.
Right.
You know, as long as we confine to the area of singing, dancing, and doing something with a ball, hey, we're all right. But if, you know, when we get in the political arena, that's when 50% of America shuts down.
Right.
And while if we want power, America shuts down. And look, couldn't have been any more qualified person to be elected to president by white folks' standards than Barack Obama.
Correct.
And look what they did.
Yep.
On the night he was being inaugurated, the white leadership of the Republican Party got together and made a deal among themselves that he would not be a successful president.
He would be a one-term president. That's exactly what they said.
And he couldn't get anything done. They didn't want him to get anything done, even if it was good for America.
Right.
Well, that's called being a traitor. That's called caring more about race than about country.
Right.
And, you know, they got away with it. They limited his effectiveness. And Joe Biden has been even more effective because first of all, he's a white man.
Right.
Second of all, he has tremendous connections in the Senate and knows everything in the world about the legislative process. And that's how he's been able to get a whole lot of things done. And again, young black people, look and see what he's done before you decide what you're going to do, whether you're going to vote for a racist named Donald Trump, or you're going to vote for a good man named Joe Biden. And I'm not bothered by the age thing because I don't see it has affected him in any adverse way in doing his job. What I want to hear is, how did age cause him to do anything less than be excellent as president so far?
Right.
So you can joke all you want. You can project all you want. Oh, Joe. But you following Donald Trump, because Donald Trump is saying all this stuff. And what is he, 4 years younger than Joe Biden?
Correct.
So Joe Biden is old. Donald Trump's not. Give me a fucking break.
And Trump.
Pardon my French.
No, it's
but,
okay.
You know, Trump. I'm from France.
Trump didn't do anything that he promised to do when he got in office anyway. So, you know, but people don't look at that.
Well, it's people who get all their political information from Facebook who scare me.
Yeah.
In our community.
Yeah.
People who don't pay attention to national news, they scare me. People don't pay attention to the variety of issues that we need to be successful about in order to become full-fledged citizens of this country. They're not thinking like this. They have strong opinions. They're getting their information from unreliable sources, the internet. There's nobody editing there. There's nobody saying, well, is this fair? Is this blah, blah? You know, it's Wild West. And so we're starting to believe anything. And, you know, if you don't stand for something, you will fall for anything.
Correct.
And so we got to stand for something. And so when these young people start paying attention to what's happening and what's not happening in the black community that needs to be corrected, and where the political process is the only place to correct it, we need to get involved with that, at least vote intelligently.
Right.
Know what the issues are. Don't just get up on one issue, on the basis of one issue, like Israel, for example, and say, I'm not voting for Joe Biden because he's not with the Palestinians. And last but not least, I said that a couple times. He is with the Palestinians. He is having a terrible fight with Netanyahu, who's the real enemy.
Right.
You know, when Trump is the president, you don't say America's the enemy. You say Trump is the enemy. Likewise, when Israel has a bad leader, you don't say Israel is the bad country. You say their leadership is awful. And Bibi Netanyahu, his real name, but the nickname is Bibi. Bibi needs to go. Bibi's why we in this war.
Oh, absolutely.
Bibi does not want a two-state solution.
Absolutely.
Bibi does not respect Palestinian sovereignty. And people can only put up with that for so long before they recognize that the only way to change things is by violence. And Bibi brought that on. Bibi was asleep at the switch instead of guarding the border. He was trying to divide the country about the judiciary so that he could bend the judiciary to his will to avoid being criminally prosecuted. Who's that sound like?
Does sound like Trump. Yep.
So that's the problem over there. Poor leadership. But we have to know enough about the situation in order to come up with opinions that have nuance and depth. We've got to read. We've got to get the information from reliable sources. We've got to talk to the Palestinians. We've got to talk to the Jews. That's how you do it. It's
right.
Called critical thinking. You don't believe it just because it's in writing. You don't believe it because it's on Facebook. You don't believe it because somebody said it. It's got to be true. And so you got to check the sources of information to make sure you're not drinking bullshit instead of water.
Right.
So, you know, hey, that's just the ravings of an elderly man.
Well, I appreciate the rantings and the ravings. I really do. It's been a pleasure talking to you and you talking to us. And you dropped a lot of jewels on us today, and I really appreciate you, sir.
Hey, man, thank you. And I'm grateful to be a member of the black community. I'm grateful to be a fighter for black people, and I'm most of all grateful for the support I get for what I do. And I couldn't be here without you, black folks. I mean, you put the food on my table, the clothes on my back, the roof over my head, my kids in the best schools. You bought me the car I drive. Without you, I could not be here. And without you, I could not be me.
Well, we always appreciate you, and we'll be talking again soon.
All right, my brother. Be good.
You too. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. That was Billy Murphy, the Honorable William H. Murphy, Jr. I am so glad that I was able to get him. He truly is black history walking in the city of Baltimore and around the country. So if you ever, ever, ever get an opportunity to talk to him, please don't miss that opportunity. He's got lots to say, and he is such a straight shooter. And I really appreciate those kinds of people. Well, we have come to the end of the hour today. Actually, we've gone over a little bit, but I got to tell you, when you have Billy Murphy on a roll, you don't stop him. You let him say what he's going to say because you don't know what he's going to say, and he dropped some jewels today. So we did run over a little bit. I apologize, but thanks for staying with me. All right, I've got to run, but before I do, I want to remind you that if you've missed any portion of this show or you've missed any shows throughout the year, you can always go to my website, voiceswired.com. Click on the Let's Talk tab. All of my shows are listed there from newest to oldest. And please give me some feedback. Let me know how you felt about this show. Give me some topics that you would like me to talk about that are important to you. Hit me up on IG, add on with Brian Pettaway. But today, please relax, chill out, watch the All-Star game, do nothing. Because like I say every week, the best part about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. So wake up tomorrow morning invigorated on President's Day, feeling great, feeling amazing, conquering the world, having the best week you can have. And I will catch you here next week right here on 1500radio.com, Baltimore's authentic multimedia experience. Have a great week, people. Peace.